I was thinking about the war in Iraq late last week when we saw the images of President George W. Bush making an arrested landing on the deck of the aircraft carrier Abraham Lincoln off the coast of California. What a PR stunt, I thought. But I suppose if you've got the entire US Navy at your disposal, you can do it. I couldn't help thinking to myself what would have happened if the Viking jet had overshot the angled flight deck and landed in the sea. Honey, I just killed the president. Anyway, that aside, we're here today to listen to a man who is Australia's most distinguished defence analyst. Paul Dibb is chairman of the Strategic and Defence Studies Centre in the Research School of Pacific and Asian Studies at the Australian National University. He's held a number of other key offices in defence, intelligence and foreign affairs matters. He's also a member of the Australian Foreign Minister's Foreign Affairs Council and has been nominated as an Australian representative on the ASEAN Regional Forum Register of Experts and Eminent Persons. Who better than to talk to us about what the war in Iraq means to Australia, both short-term and longer-term? Please welcome Professor Paul Dibb, AM.
I think the answer, Robert, to your question about what would have happened if the Viking aircraft had overshot the Abraham Lincoln is that my good friend, the Vice President of the United States, Dick Cheney, would have been smiling. I don't think so, but there is a process for the smooth transition of power in the worst circumstances. Ladies and gentlemen, I need to apologise to you. I think this is going to be a fairly dismal sort of address. Pessimism, if you like, is not just my business, but it's all our businesses since September the 11th, 2001. And let me remind you, October the 12th, 2002 in Bali. I'm delighted, Robert, to be the guest of the South Australian Press Club. As far as I'm concerned, as a former senior defence official, Adelaide is home to crucial defence science and defence industry capabilities out at Mawson Lakes, the Submarine Corporation, and so on. And we need to build that minimum critical mass that we have in this state that, frankly, no other state has. The question I'm addressing today, does Australia's defence policy need radical change since the war with Iraq, needs to be raised because our participation in that war, as you all know, has generated a keen public debate on Australia's defence priorities and indeed on the nature of the US alliance. In the short time available to me today, I will explore four key defence policy issues. First, and importantly, the primacy of our alliance with the United States. Second, whether we should now drop the defence of Australia and the priority we give to our immediate region in favour of an expeditionary force designed for distant military conflicts with our allies. Third, the military lessons of the war in Iraq, and in particular, whether we need a much larger army. And fourth, if I get time, whether we can continue to spend only 1.8% of GDP on defence, or whether our ambitions for defence now exceed our practical financial grasp. Well, turning to the first of those, the US alliance. The United States alliance, which in its policy dimensions I managed for 3 years in the late 80s and early 90s, is of fundamental importance to Australia. In my view, Australia is now the second most important ally, the second most important ally of the United States in the world. It wasn't always the case. In the Cold War, and we were talking about, you do all remember the Cold War, don't you, and the Soviet Union? Good. Some of our master's degree students who are 22 years old don't remember the Cold War and the Soviet Union. They've asked me, are there any good books on that? In the Cold War, arguably, Canada was of more importance to the United States because of the defense of North America, what's known as NORAD, and the fact that, unlike us, Canada had an armoured brigade in the Fulda Gap, which was going to be the main attack point of the Soviet armoured divisions. And arguably also in the Cold War, whilst Japan is not as close an ally as we are, and never has been, it has never been part of the inner alliance club. Japan in the Cold War was of much greater strategic importance to the United States because of the Soviet Far East and the Soviet Pacific Fleet with its ballistic missile firing submarines. Whatever, the point now is, and you've seen it demonstrated at the Crawford, Texas branch over the weekend, Australia is now the second most important ally of the United States in the world. And that has to be good and useful for Australia, because the United States, since the end of the Soviet Union, is now a power without equal, probably in world history. And I will come back to that. But there are some related points that are often ignored about the nature of the alliance. The alliance gives us extended nuclear deterrence. That is, we do not develop nuclear weapons of our own. The United States puts a nuclear umbrella over us, as indeed it does over Japan and other allies. Importantly, in the event, as unlikely as it is, as incredible as it is for the foreseeable future, of some future power in the region emerging with the desire to invade Australia, then there would be no doubt in my mind of the utility of the US alliance. That is, America would come to our assistance, as it did in the Second World War. Also, the alliance, in my view, helps to ensure an American military presence in this part of the world. And along with the other democratic alliances that America has with Japan and South Korea, it ensures an anchoring of the American military position in the region. And let me remind you, Asia without an American presence would be a dangerous place for Australia. Why? Because Asia without America would give rise potentially to the dominance by some rising, ambitious major power, a China, an India, or some other major power. And most importantly, and I cannot stress this too much from my point of view, the alliance gives Australia unique access in the entire Asia-Pacific region to highly sensitive American intelligence, defense science, and advanced weapon systems, which give us what we call a technological edge. I cannot stress too much those practical benefits of the alliance. You cannot measure them in dollar terms. Even if you thought of doubling our defense expenditure, you would not be able to bring to Australia the unique access we have to high-grade intelligence, defense science, and advanced weapon systems. The other point is the nature of contemporary American power and what it means for Australia. You've just heard me mention that the United States is a power without equal, certainly in recent world history. The measures I have of American power, I think, are truly stunning. America accounts for about 32% of world gross domestic product. It accounts for 43% of world military expenditure, and that proportion will go up as America ramps up its military expenditure. So soon it will be 50%. America accounts for about half of world military arms production, and at least 60% of world military research and development expenditure. And I think that latter figure is a gross underestimation. If we were to talk about the proportion of advanced world military R&D, the American figure would be much closer to 75 or 80%. And I could give you other figures, but they will do, won't they? For the next 20 years at least, and maybe longer, there is no single power or combination of powers that can emerge to challenge American military power. No single power, not a China, no combination of powers. But the impact of September the 11th, 2001, on the United States must absolutely not be underestimated. Unless you've been there and talked with them and seen the anger, the humiliation, and the desire to do something about it, then you do not understand that. I was in America in early October last year, and I guess because of the close inner intelligence alliance, I had meetings with the Vice President, Dick Cheney, the Deputy Secretary of Defense, Paul Wolfowitz, the Deputy Secretary of State, Richard Armitage. And clearly there's not much I can tell you about that, except to say they were for real about the issue of September the 11th. It has marked a fundamental change in the United States. At a time when they defeated peacefully the Soviet Union, there came this, if you like, bolt out of the blue, this humiliation. And we've seen the impact of that with regard to the war on the Taliban in Afghanistan, in which we were involved, and the most recent three-week, very quick victory over Iraq. There's a great deal of judgments about the future of American power. In my view, they will focus on the other members of the so-called axis of evil. The United States now is a power that intends to use its military power, not open-endedly and not without risk, but is a power that, having been humiliated, is a power that intends to intervene. It's a power that is increasingly demanding of what it expects of allies. You remember what George Bush said after September 11th? Either you're with us or you're with the terrorists. And I think this is going to be very demanding of allied commitments. And we've seen that in terms of our own commitment in Iraq. And there may well be other situations that we will have to contemplate. What does America now expect of Australia? Well, we are the second most important ally. And I think if there are future likely conflicts, and I'm not predicting that they will occur, then our contribution will be expected. The war on terror will continue. It's a bit of a misnomer, isn't it? Because it's not a conventional war. How do you measure when victory occurs? Very hard. But there's no doubt that the United States will continue to focus and expand on the set of countries and targets which harbour terrorists, and in addition, rogue regimes that are covertly developing weapons of mass destruction, chemical, biological, nuclear. We were talking at our table how the world has changed. In the Cold War, there were rules of the game. There were rules of the game, as dangerous as it was. There were geographical no-go areas for each side. There were counting rules about nuclear weapons, which Australia was deeply involved with. I was deeply involved with. Now we have terrorists who attack the heartland of American power, financial, military, in terms of the targets. And we've seen with weapons of mass destruction there's great uncertainty, because that modern technology allows you to covertly develop these weapons. If you've got a half-decent chemical industry, petrochemical industry, or a half-decent health industry with research laboratories, guess what? You dial up the temperature a bit, and you've got chemical and biological weapons. And there's now a nuclear domino effect afoot. It started with America first, then the Soviet Union, then China, then India, then Pakistan, now we've got North Korea, Israel, and a great deal of other number of other countries who have that potential, some of them in our own region. So it's not in Australia's interest to see the proliferation of these weapons. There are other potential contingencies involving the United States that would involve us in much more difficult decisions, and the key one is Taiwan. And you may want to ask me questions about that. In addition to being the second most important ally that has made extremely professional military contributions both in Afghanistan and Iraq, You should not forget, and neither should this government, that the United States expects Australia to look after its immediate region. Colin Powell has said, we look to Australia to lead with regard to Indonesia. A non-trivial task when you consider that Indonesia is the fourth largest country in the world and in a highly unstable situation of transition from an authoritarian regime to, hopefully, some form of democracy. Then we have broken back states like the Solomon Islands and potentially Papua New Guinea, which is hovering on that status, in our immediate ambit. I am one of those, and I find it frankly insulting that I have to say this, but in Canberra these days one has to. I'm one of those who've had probably the longest continuous experience of managing the US alliance of anybody in that town. I first got high-level security clearances in 1970. There are some issues about the alliance and about how the United States wants to see the world develop. And I want to quote to you something from our most eminent journalist, Paul Kelly, which he's just had published in a very conservative American journal called The National Interest, spring of this year. And he says the following, and I quote, "The wider strategic challenge for Australia is to strike a new balance between its regional security needs and its global commitments to the United States as a senior ally. Australia," he says, "cannot afford the impression to develop in Southeast Asia that it is merely the regional agent for the United States." He goes on to say, "Australia must operate more as an independent player within the alliance." That is also my view. Tony Blair, the other key member of the alliance, the most important ally of the United States, says, and I quote, "The problem that people have with the United States, not the rabid anti-Americans, but the average middle ground, is not that they oppose them on weapons of mass destruction or international terrorism. People listen to the US on these issues and may well agree with them, but they want the US to listen back." And that is my view too. Now, there's much more I could say on this complex issue, but let me repeat, the alliance is crucial to Australia's defence posture. We are now closely involved with the United States in its new activities, and this needs to be handled while still being a very close and committed ally in terms of also balancing that alliance with our relations with what is a highly unstable region to our north. Moving on to the second subject, a highly contentious one also. Should we drop the defence of Australia for an expeditionary force? Should we reverse Australia's current defence priorities? And if so, why? Now, there are many of you in this room who know that there's been throughout Australia's history an historical struggle between, if you like, defence of Australia advocates and supporters of an expeditionary force approach. And traditionally we've had very capable and substantial expeditionary forces. Boer War, First World War, Second World War, Korean War, Vietnam War, and most recently. Let me remind you, it was the Fraser government in 1976 that said Australia should have a more self-reliant defence policy. Not a self-sufficient one, but in line with the Nixon doctrine, where the United States expects allies, short of invasion, to be able to defend itself. We developed a policy in which Australia's Army, Navy and Air Force would no longer operate as subordinate parts of American or British Army, Navy and Air Forces. They would be developed as a joint force. And let me tell you, having been involved from the late 70s with that doctrine, it was very difficult to develop. There was a lot of resistance. I don't have time to walk you through the ups and downs of that situation. But let me remind you of what the Howard government's excellent December 2000 white paper had to say about priorities. And this was the most owned defence white paper by any government in my experience. For nearly a year, the cabinet discussed in detail alternative views, intelligence advice, budgetary advice. The December 2000 white paper says, the first priority of the government, of any government, is the defence of Australia. Secondly, our immediate region. Third, the broader Southeast Asian area. Fourth, Northeast Asia, where there are limits to what we can contribute. And fifth, our contributions to global security. The question now is whether we're going to reverse those priorities. Whatever decision governments come to, and I don't believe that Mr. Howard is going to reverse those priorities at all, and I'll come back to that, I need to stress to you that whatever concepts are derived by whatever governments in the coming years, my experience and that of others in this room who've been practically at the end of managing multi-billion dollar defence projects is that money is not a free good. As Sir Arthur Tang, the former permanent secretary of defence, when we used to have permanent secretaries, said, strategy without money ain't strategy. It isn't some academic open-ended exercise, some wish list by Army, Navy or Air Force. There has to be trade-offs. Money is limited. And therefore you need a rigorous and tough-minded set of force structure priorities. And successive governments, since 1976, have given priority to the force structure priorities I set out for you. The defence of Australia, the immediate region, the rest of Asia, and indeed our global commitments. If you don't have a set of rigorous force structure priorities, then you have to think about how do you fund them. If you want an expeditionary force, like the British have, then spend what the British do on defence. Not 1.8% of GDP, 2.8%. And better start thinking about Admiral acquiring aircraft carriers and screens of destroyers and submarines and long-range bombers and a large armoured army. That is not within our practical grasp unless a government decides to spend a lot more on defence. At the other end of the extreme, I can detect in some quarters in Canberra, certainly not with the Prime Minister, a sense of complacency about our region. Statements that there is no military threat to Australia for the next 15 years. Well, this period of great strategic unpredictability and discontinuity can only lead such judgments, and I use the word advisedly, to be complacent. There are some issues that the Defence Minister Robert Hill is addressing about the size and capabilities of the army. And I'll come back to those in a moment. And some of you will disagree with what I'm about to say. But those who want to expand the army from 25,000 to 32,000, which is our current issue, had better tell me where the extra $1,000 million a year for personnel costs alone, plus equipment, plus barracks, is going to come from. Unless a government decides to spend a lot more on defence. Or we decide to cut the Air Force and the Navy. A high-risk situation when no intelligence agency can say there is no military threat to Australia in the foreseeable future. There are some sound arguments for modest increases in the size of the army, not only but particularly special forces, and better equipment. Armed reconnaissance helicopters, troop lift helicopters, night vision devices and so on. How has all this issue been resolved by the Howard government? Well, you remember what I call their excellent December 2000 white paper is still basically in place. If you read Robert Hill's strategic or defence update document, which was issued in February this year, this document, he talks about the principles set out in the December 2000 white paper remaining sound, but that some rebalancing of capability and expenditure will be necessary. Well, we're still waiting to hear about what rebalancing, and presumably that will come out of the budget. He goes on to say that this rebalancing will not, and I quote, fundamentally alter the size, structure, and roles of the Defence Force. But we need greater readiness and mobility and interoperability. And I think he's correct in that regard. And with regard to expeditionary capabilities, Robert Hill says the following. ADF involvement in coalition operations further afield is somewhat more likely than in the recent past, but involvement in coalition operations is likely to be of the type witnessed in Afghanistan, and which the government has considered in Iraq, remember this is February, that is, limited to the provision of important niche capabilities. He is dead right. No fundamental change. No restructuring to an expeditionary force. This brings me to the question of the military lessons that we need to learn from the war in Iraq. And this is a current debate in Canberra, and the jury's out. We've still got to get a fair bit of the evidence in. In a war that lasted 3 weeks to occupy a country of 24 million, it was truly phenomenal. The Gulf War, which I was involved in as Deputy Secretary of Defence, was 6 weeks. In the Gulf War, we were told this was a revolution in military affairs. No, it wasn't. It was the first time we used real-time, in a limited way, satellite information. This war has seen, in my view, the revolution in military affairs occur. There's great talk about, was it the dominance of air power? 36,000 strike sorties, 70% at least of the weapons, precision weapons. Or was it the decisive use of armour, tanks, and heavy artillery? We haven't seen the analysis yet of how much of the destruction of tanks and artillery and armoured personnel carriers was from air power. But they are not the issues. The dominance of air power or the utility of heavy armour and artillery. The big lesson that Australia needs to learn is that this was what in the lingo is called network-centric warfare. That is, real-time intelligence from overhead satellite systems, near real-time continuous surveillance, including from UAVs, fused together with highly precise modern weapons, which resulted, whether you like it or not, in minimum civilian casualties. And that sometimes a soldier on the ground would illuminate a target for an airstrike, or indeed a naval weapon strike from a cruiser or a submarine. It has arrived. This sort of capability, scaled and affordable for Australia, is crucial, in my view, to the ADF's what we call maintaining a knowledge edge over the region. We will always have a small defence force. We can never afford to lose significant numbers of platforms or people in combat. We must have a technological advantage. And the alliance and our own capabilities, including in this state, will allow us to do that. But my concern is that the defence force is dragging its feet on this issue. And you may want to come back to that issue. Another lesson is that the Defence Force's rigorous and professional peacetime training certainly paid off. The SAS, which is the force we use most frequently, small, scarce, expensive, time after time has proven its worth in Timor, in Afghanistan, and Iraq. Our Air Force, for the first time since the Korean War, half a century ago, used combat fighters in anger. Our Navy, David, for the first time since the Vietnam War, used naval gunfire support and other activities with clearance divers, and did brilliantly. And this shows the value in rigorous and tough professional peacetime training. You've heard President Bush describe Australia's armed forces as the best in the world. I think we've demonstrated to Washington and to others that we can make useful contributions with what Robert Hill calls niche capabilities to coalition operations. I have one caveat, but that only applies to wars of short duration. We don't have the sustainability. What are the lessons that must not be learned from the Iraq War? It is important to understand that America's overwhelming military power has limited relevance for the Defence Force of Australia. Waging large-scale, high-intensity war is simply beyond our means. As the Howard government said in its December 2000 white paper, and I quote, "The government has decided against the development of heavy armoured forces suitable for contributions to coalition forces in high-intensity conflicts," end of quote. My view, and there'll be those of you who disagree, our experience in Iraq does not now mean that we need to go out and purchase new main battle tanks. It is a fantasy to believe that tanks would be of more than limited military utility in our immediate region. Who believes that they would be used in cities such as Jakarta and Port Moresby? It's a lunatic idea. And they could only be of incidental value to US operations in high-intensity warfare. This is not an argument against armour. It's not an argument against new lateral solutions to the sorts of capabilities army needs. Another lesson is that our Navy, Army and Air Force elements in the Iraq War operated as separate entities in Iraq as part of the coalition's sea, land and air operations. We simply didn't have a large enough force to operate our own joint force. I think it would be a pity if, and it's an if, a mindset develops in the Defence Force that moves away from jointness as a result. We have led the world in many ways in the idea of joint force operations. And whilst it is certainly useful for the Defence Force to gain experience in distant theatres such as Afghanistan and Iraq, It must not ignore the continuing priority to be expert in operations in the archipelago to our north. This is a demanding physical environment, as we discovered in East Timor, which is only 600 kilometres off Darwin. And by the way, if some of us hadn't forced Army to locate an Army brigade group in the north of Australia in the late 80s, where the hell would we have been in terms of the logistic operation in East Timor, operating out of Sydney and Melbourne? Answer, nowhere. Therefore, the ADF must continue to give priority to having the military capabilities for sustained operations in the archipelago to our north, including, if necessary, in two separate locations at the same time. That is current doctrine, but we ain't got there yet. The great risk now is that the Defence Force, having done brilliantly well in Iraq, having been in what many of them rightly would see as a real war with the big boys, will take its eyes off what the Defence Minister, Senator Hill, calls a troubled region to our north. Southeast Asia and the South Pacific are potentially unstable and more exposed to world events than they were. And we need to remember that the United States, as I've said, looks to Australia to take the lead when it comes to crises in our own region, a non-trivial task for a country of 20 million. Finally, is spending 1.8% of GDP enough? Question mark. The Howard government has given priority to defence, and it cannot be faulted in that regard, in my view. It has done very well. For each of the last two financial years, the defence budget has increased by 3%, or about $500 million increase for the first year, $1 billion increase for the second year, and I'm keeping my fingers crossed that Peter Costello will announce next week another $500 million increase, which will then mean that the increase from the base level of the defence budget in 3 years has increased by $1,500 million. A lot of money. A government that has done exceptionally well. And I would note that this performance of the Howard government compares with zero real growth in the defence spending by successive governments over the previous 15 years. But defence is expensive business, ladies and gentlemen. I was in defence yesterday getting a briefing on the Joint Strike Fighter that will replace the F-18s and the F-111s. We're looking at an indicative cost, as we say in defence, hold your breath, of $15 billion. With the new air warfare destroyers, which I strongly support, we're looking at an indicative cost of some $4.2, $4.5 billion for three ships. If we are to continue to have a knowledge edge, remember that, a technological advantage over our region, we must absolutely persevere with these capabilities, whilst at the same time looking after modest increases in our army, but no expeditionary force that would dismantle our capacity for the independent defence of this nation. I think, even despite these increases, we're still trying to do defence on the cheap. Remember I said the United Kingdom, which for the first time, by the way, since William the Conqueror, faces no threat from Europe, spends 2.8% of GDP. And we, with what Hill calls the troubled region, the great uncertainties of the future of the world's fourth largest country, Papua New Guinea in addition, and the islands, we spend 1.8% of GDP. With three times our population, the British sent 20 times as many troops to the Middle East. I'm not decrying what we did. I think the quality of what we did was brilliant. But you see there's some issue there of pulling our weight with the coalition. I can see what I call a coming train smash with the defence budget. That's a bit dramatic. What I mean is that the government's promised, well thought out, rigorous, 10-year defence capability plan is no longer affordable, even at 3% growth, given the blowout in the costs of key projects. In addition, there are escalating personnel costs, and there are very serious shortfalls in logistics and maintenance. Some of that is as a result of the unprecedented tempo, operational tempo, of the Defence Force, and some of it is the ever-increasing costs of maintaining what are called legacy systems, such as F-111s and the older FFGs, the Leopard tanks, the M113s. A very close friend of mine, on whose counsel I depend a great deal, General John Baker, previous Chief of the Defence Force, has proposed in a book that I edited in the United States the year before last that Australia should increase its defence spending to at least 2.5% of GDP. Still won't be as big as the United Kingdom, but it would be a substantial increase. What would, ladies and gentlemen, 2.5% of GDP cost over and above the 1.8% we currently spend? Well, Mr. Costello, I'm asking for another $5,000 million a year. Hands up those in this room who believe that is a credible ask. Oh, come on, Admiral, you can't do that to me. Thank you, David. So, there are enormous pressures on the budget, even from a government that has been very good with our defence expenditure. The question is, how can we manage all this? So what are my conclusions? We have seen, sometimes with difficulty, in recent times, that the Australian people will support overseas military operations in support of our American ally in its war on terror and its activities against weapons of mass destruction. But they will only do so, in my view, if they feel secure at home, and Bali taught us some lessons there, and they believe that Australia gives priority also to a secure region. There is undoubtedly now a growing sense of insecurity in our homeland following the terrible attack in Bali last year. That brought home to us our vulnerability. The challenge for any Australian government now is to devise a set of credible and affordable defence policies that accommodate our domestic and regional defence concerns, as well as contributing where appropriate to the undoubted priority we need to give to Allied operations much further afield. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Paul. We'll follow the usual procedure of questions from working media first, and then if we have the time, move on to others. I would like to try and finish as close as possible to 2 o'clock. So, who'd like to kick off? Please identify yourself first.
Hi, Meredith Booth from The Advertiser. You say we're headed for a train crash with budget if we don't increase our percentage spending of GDP. What would be the result if we didn't increase?
If we did not.
Well, it would be the eternal issue that those of us who had experience of managing defence budgets over the decades is that there would be deferrals, cancellations, and what we former defence bureaucrats call programming pressures. That is flicking things to years 4 and 5 rather than years 1 and 2. You might think that that is not a serious issue. It sure as hell is a serious issue. And the pressure then would come on, and the classical sort of response in defence when you go through budget pressures is that when you go round a table of senior managers, the person you ask does this. You understand? Not on my watch. I think it's important that the Howard government perseveres with that outstandingly good December 2000 white paper, adjusted for the geopolitical and other strategic pressures we see coming to bear. And as you've heard me say, although I'm against throwing the baby out with the bathwater, if I might say that, to create an expeditionary force, and honestly, there are very few in Canberra arguing that, that some adjustments will have to be made. And if, for argument's sake, Army gets a bit more, well then, there's going to have to be some give elsewhere. And my concern would be, we don't elect, for instance, as a result of that, allow the air warfare destroyers, $4.5 billion, to slip to the right. Or that we so cut the Joint Strike Fighter program that we don't have a credible minimum air power mass. I mean, we're dealing with small numbers in this country. There isn't much room to give.
Professor Nance Haxton from ABC Radio's PM program. I suppose following on from Meredith's question, really, what does Australia risk if it doesn't increase that spending? Does it compromise its regional defence?
Well, you know, when I talk about my concerns about what elsewhere I've called the arc of instability, now there's a nice phrase, you know, Indonesia, Papua New Guinea, the islands of the South Pacific. And from my point of view, and it's obviously my personal view, a New Zealand that is going in a different direction from us. Nobody's arguing, and I'm not, that we face direct military attack or invasion in the foreseeable future. But we saw in East Timor, where we deployed, Martin, it was 5,000 troops. And for the first time, we led a joint force operation brilliantly, and we led a United Nations operation brilliantly. Only 600 kilometres off Darwin, we had problems with water supply, fuel supply, ammunition, and so on. The doctrine tells us in the white paper, and I endorse it, we need a brigade group and a battalion to operate in 2 areas of the archipelago simultaneously. We are not at that situation. What would happen would be that we would have a degraded capability. And we must never take our eye off, as we've seen in Iraq, the capacity to do higher intensity operations. That is, having a small but modern air force, a small but modern navy. We've got F-111s, which we ordered in 1963? Three? Four? We've got the FFGs, the 4 oldest of which are wearing out. We're hammering them in terms of concurrent operations. So what you'd have would be a steady degradation of our capacity to even deploy niche capacities. It wouldn't be dramatic, it would be a rundown. By the way, I am not arguing that any Australian government would take us down the path of a peacekeeping force only, which is what New Zealand has done. New Zealanders would disagree with me, of course.
How do you propose we, as a nation, should balance our responsibilities to the US, which has become such a strong ally through this last conflict, and those regional responsibilities?
Well, I think it's what John Howard has quite rightly said, and I don't know what pressure the Prime Minister came under at the Crawford Ranch. Not much, I fancy, because my friend Rich Armitage has said in public, we Americans understand that Australia is not going to contribute substantial peacekeeping forces in Iraq. The British, by the way, really want us to make a major contribution and are putting pressure on us. I think Howard says we'll do our niche contribution, to use Robert Hill's correct phrase, and then we'll reduce it. We have from 2,000 to 1,000. And Howard, I think, understands better than any politician in this country that in addition to being a good ally, he needs to walk and chew gum at the same time, and that is have the capacity for homeland security and operations in our immediate region. And therefore, it's not an either-or question, all the way with the United States and no homeland defence, or all defence of Australia and isolationism. We can and should be able to do both. All I'm saying is, at 1.8% of GDP, even with a budget growing by 3%, it's going to get increasingly hard to avoid the budgetary pressures I've outlined.
Brad Crouch from the Sunday Mail. Professor, when talking about the lessons of Iraq, you mentioned it was a network-centric war and stressed that Australia needs to maintain its knowledge edge. You went on to say that the ADF is dragging its feet and that perhaps you'd come back to it. Well, could you come back to us and tell us how it's dragging its feet and why it's dragging its feet?
Some in the room will disagree with what I'm about to say, David. First, to be fair, network-centric warfare is neither cheap nor uncomplicated to introduce. It's neither cheap nor uncomplicated. The Americans have been at it for well over a decade, and let me remind you, the Americans spend, in US dollar terms, real dollars, $1,000 million a day. A day. We spend $14.6 billion Australian a year. We need to develop our own concepts for network-centric warfare whilst having, as I've said, unique access in this part of the world to American satellite intelligence and surveillance information. One size does not fit all. Just transferring American, or indeed British systems, won't work. Things need to be scaled and affordable for Australia, our unique size, and our unique geographical operating environment. I think there are still some in our defence forces who are, for instance, much more preoccupied with the new Joint Strike Fighter, or the old air warfare destroyer, or getting new main battle tanks, than this much more diffuse idea of network-centric warfare. Next week, the Chief of the Defence Force, Peter Cosgrove, is holding a conference on network-centric warfare. I shall attend that on one of those days, and I'll be interested to see what progress we're making and whether we're going to give much more urgent attention to this crucial issue.
On a different issue today, Meredith Fitzgerald from the Appetite. On a different issue today, the Australian Submarine Corp based in Adelaide, is looking to be sold, and it said that there's too many naval shipbuilders in Australia. What is your view on the future of the shipbuilding industry in South Australia?
You're asking me to commit ritual suicide, eh? Some of you, I think, know that I did some work with Peter Reith when he was Defence Minister on developing a policy for a much more strategic approach to defence industry in this country. I know it's Mr. Howard's view that in the past it has not been good enough that we've spent all this money on defence, and yet, whilst we've tried to develop an industry base, it has been ad hoc and disconnected. We need a strategic approach to defence industry in this country, not to subsidise it, except in rare circumstances, but to understand
Given that we're now contracted out most of the maintenance of the Defence Force into the private sector, it is of absolute importance that we have confidence that the defence industry base can support the Defence Force both in peace and in wartime operations. And that secondly, we have those strategically important capabilities that will give us the knowledge edge. The sorts of things that in this town and out at Mawson Lakes and at Salisbury are being done. My view is that if government doesn't encourage the rationalisation of the limited shipbuilding in this country, then the marketplace will impose a monopoly in any case. And so we'd be better off doing what the Americans, the British, the French and the Germans have done, and that is nudge things in the strategic direction that we want. And my vision is for some alliance entity. And if you're going to ask me, do I think South Australia is well placed to be favourably regarded in that way? Absolutely. If you work hard on it.
Reverend Tobin, Adelaide Institute. Professor Dibbs, I was in Jordan at the beginning of the war addressing groups that opposed Saddam Hussein but also opposed the Americans because they saw the Americans merely doing Israel's job. I said it was about democracy and they laughed because they said that the American democracy model is not suited for the Middle East. In fact, it's not even suited for the Western world because the example of democracy imposed upon the German nation is today still not a democracy but an occupation. Your comment, please.
Look, I'm not an expert on the Middle East. Haven't been there, haven't studied it. My career has been studying Asia, our immediate area of strategic priority. But, look, there are different views. Again, my friend Paul Wolfowitz, you know, one of the neocons, says that it's an insult to say that democracy wouldn't work in an Arab and indeed Islamic country. Give it a chance. There are other people at my own university who specialise totally on the Middle East who say that, you know, Iraq is an artificial construct by my British forebears in the wake of the First World War, that it's never had a democratic tradition, and that you've got the Shias, the Sunnis and the Kurds, and they'll be at each other's throats, and as we speak, QED. One hopes that the democratic experiment works. It had better work. It had better work. Because if we get a theocratic state in Iraq, juxtaposed with Iran, then look out for trouble.
Professor Deb, John Bruni, Centre for Asian Studies, University of Adelaide. I was just wondering, you were talking earlier about Blair and his appeal to Middle Road people who kind of feel a little bit ambivalent about... Is that me? Maybe I'll stand. Oh, okay. Well, I was just wondering, from an Australian perspective, and given all the kind of things that you've just been talking about, the difficulty with trying to stay abreast of modern technology, given the exponential rise in this kind of technology, and given our newfound closeness with the United States and the US's acknowledgement of the difficulty for Australia to continue pushing ourselves out on the front the way that we are, can we not cut a diplomatic deal with the United States whereby they give us some cut-price equipment, where we don't have to go cap in hand to the Australian public and say, listen, it's either homeland security or it's our alliance relationship with the United States, you pick. I mean, I know, you know, we live in the great free market environment and all that kind of thing, but I also know that from current situations, the United States, in spite of its, you know, claims to being a unilateralist power, it still needs its friends and allies. And given Australia's unique capabilities, surely, you know, there would be some kind of gain for them to be able to sort of help us along our way.
Look, I think there's no better time, given our salience and profile in Washington right now, to be pressing some of these issues. And in a different way, of course, You've seen how our contributions in Afghanistan and indeed in Iraq have apparently had some significant impact on President Bush's desire to negotiate a free trade agreement with us. By the way, that would have never happened in the Cold War. In the Cold War, trade and defence were always kept separate. That's another example of how the world has changed. It remains to be seen, of course, in that context, whether we can break through the congressional resistance with regard to their agriculture lobby. But coming back to your point, I mean, it's rare in the defence game that you get cut-price deals, and if you do, watch out for what you've got. But you will recall, and I must say, much to my surprise at the time, Paul Keating, when he was Prime Minister, suddenly announced we'd buy a whole bunch more of near-new, unused, one only careful owner, of F-111G models. And we got massive spare parts, not least because we're now the sole operator. I think the issue is in terms of our own self-respect, not going cap in hand for special financial deals, but making absolutely sure, in a way that sometimes in the past, in my personal experience, we haven't always made sure, that we get the absolutely most sensitive cooking versions rather than the export back burner versions of weapons platforms, combat systems and missiles. And that is an important issue for us and is a fundamental test of the alliance.
Last question, please.
Rebecca Kerr from the Advertiser. I'm just wondering, how do you budget for terrorist attacks? Very simple, quick question.
With difficulty. You've seen that the government is spending significantly more on counter-terrorism. We've significantly upgraded our intelligence capabilities, ASIO, Defence Signals Directorate and others, our special forces, a special regiment to deal with chemical, biological and nuclear attack, airport security and so on. At the end of the day, you know, in defence terms, it ain't big money. But also at the end of the day, I'm not one of those who believe that the war on terror is only, or indeed especially, a role for the Defence Force. I mean, there are limits to what the Defence Force can do in terms of suppressing terrorism at its roots, in terms of its religious origins, its economic origins, if you believe that, its ethnic origins, and so on. It involves much more than the Defence Force. The Defence Force can clearly, where there is a defined threat such as the Taliban in Afghanistan, use force. But where it involves terror in our own region, we have to have cooperative, consultative capabilities, both with regional defence forces and regional military forces, including the excellent area where we can really help of training, because we've got some of the best capabilities, both in the Defence Force and significantly in our police forces. And certainly in terms of counter-terrorism in our own country, there is a crucial role for the Defence Force, and most especially for the SAS. But as some people in this room know, it is a use of force of last resort. In the first instance, the police special action teams have to be used. We have to remember, when it comes to military action in our own country, we always have to keep a careful eye on the separation of powers. Having said that, I'm one of those who believe, and I believe this in the past, that our reserve forces, and particularly our reserve army forces, could usefully do a lot more about vital asset protection, particularly in the north of Australia. But with terrorism, it's not just the north. So what do you do about vital asset protection in a city like Adelaide? And do you use military forces for that? There are some issues of civil society involved here that are quite sensitive.
Okay, thank you, everyone. Paul, would you like to return to your seat and enjoy your dessert, your just dessert, and perhaps another glass of Shiraz? I'm going to present you in a moment with the gift we usually give to our guest speakers, a magnum of Orlando St. Hugo Coonawarra Cabernet, for you to take home. Before I say more about a few more words of thanks to you, I'm always reminded when people use that phrase, he couldn't walk and chew gum at the same time. I think I'm correct in saying it was actually Lyndon Johnson who said about Gerald Ford, he can't fart and chew gum at the same time. But of course, he got sanitized by our American cousins. One thing I didn't know today until I sat down opposite Sandra Winter Dewhurst, who's sitting opposite me at table one here, is that she's just been made State Director of the ABC. Congratulations, Sandra. Paul Dibb, that was one of the most free-ranging, world-spanning speeches I think we've heard at this press club, and it was very interesting and very well thought through. I think it put in perspective, as we hoped it would, some of the issues that arise from the war in Iraq and the events that preceded it. So thank you very much indeed for spending your time here with us today. I know he's a regular visitor to Adelaide. He goes down to Hague's Chocolates and buys chocolates down there when he's not doing other things. So thank you very much indeed. Please join me in thanking Paul Dibb.
Ladies and gentlemen, just one more piece of housekeeping so that you can then sit and relax and talk. Can I, Megan, come on up and talk to the waffle. Come on. And while she's coming forward, I'd like to remind you that we have Herbert Juradek lunch on Thursday, June 5, World Environment Day at the Stanford. The topic is Cities for Life. The invitations are out the front, and I'm sure that some of you have booked already. Okay, three. No, that's all right, we're immune. She can't see into the pot, she can't see the colour. Black. Black, C74, Patricia Rich. Table 7. And that is for the Telstra cordless telephone. I think Susan Karaskosis will probably deliver that for you. Right, another one please, Megan. And this is for Southwark Premium Car and thanks to S.A. Brewing. Slippery little sucker. Blue C, Keith Langley. Well, that's well done. Absolutely. Your next point, please. And this is an orange F76.
Yeah.
Ah, well done. Look, perhaps you'd like to arrange a concierge to deliver to you later. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.